show. If it's Thursday night, it's time for Race Trackers. Last week was relatively uneventful in the racing world, and this week New York runs its New York Breds, Maryland runs its Maryland Breds, and we await the Breeders' Cup. I'm Bill Gottemer, and my usual co-host Mike Monroe is under the weather, so I'll be alone tonight. As you know, each week we try to capture what has transpired in the racing world and bring new information to our listeners. Please spread the word about how much fun we have here each Thursday night. As I said, unfortunately, Mike Monroe is unavailable to join us tonight, so I'm on my own. Therefore, I'll be taking calls if anyone would like to call and to have a conversation. We'll also have a bit of a truncated show tonight. The call-in number tonight is 646-716-4442. Tonight, we'll be joined later on by an interview with Craig Milkowski of Timeform USA. He will tell us about his efforts to make speed figures and his method of making speed figures and how he manages to do that for each track around the country each and every day. We'll also talk about some timing differences, the timing problems that we've had with recently at various tracks with new timing methods. Before we continue, I'd like to thank last week's guests, Mark Cassie, Mike Smith, and Bob Santame. Anybody who followed Bob Santame's handicapping last week probably had a pretty good week. We probably will talk about a few of the horses that we discussed on last week's show, some of which were picked by Bob, others picked by Mike or myself. Of note, last week, Keeneland, Friday, the sprint race, Morticia scored nicely and paid $7.80, while Lowell was a disappointment. We indicated that Morticia was better at the shorter distance, and that proved to be the case. I guess it also helped that Morticia won on Friday the 13th. I guess a bit of a hunch play there. Moving on to Belmont on Saturday, we saw two stakes races, two performances, two wins by Chad Brown, one very impressive, one not so impressive. The Futurity was won by a two-year-old named Engage. It was very impressive under Jose Ortiz, a horse who's still pretty green, still hasn't really learned what it's all about, but has a tremendous amount of raw talent. Engage handled a small field, a small but talented field under Jose Ortiz, and pretty much behaved himself to the stretch this time, avoiding the difficulties he had in his last race at Saratoga, where he won despite drifting out. I would expect Engage would probably move on to the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. A half hour later, in the Pebbles, the much touted and very talented and very exciting filly Rubalinda won, but won barely holding off Bob Santame's selection party boat by the smallest of noses. Rubalinda had a different approach this time. She normally has a tremendous late kick. This time, Jose Ortiz kept her closer to the pace, actually found herself on the lead at the top of the stretch. Stretching out to a mile, she seemed to tire and didn't really finish with as much energy as she has in the past and was begging for the wire and found the wire just in time. It's not hard to know what to make of Rubalinda's effort. She might be a tremendous closing sprinter, or she might have just kind of lost interest finding herself on the lead, which was something that was completely new to her. But in any event, she's an extremely talented horse. The Rubalinda party boat exacta that we spoke of paid a very generous $16. We hope some of you had that. Again, if anybody would like to give us a call, 646-716-4442. We'd be happy to have your comments. 646-716-4442. We had some news this week, and some of it was good, some of it was bad. Two breaking news stories today. One, on the sad note, the multiple grade one stakes winner from Jimmy Jerkins, FNX, who had retired to stud in upstate New York, passed away suddenly last night from a ruptured pulmonary artery. I guess that's an artery in the horse's lungs, I believe, and died rather suddenly. Russell Cohen, the owner of FNX, posted on Twitter and on Facebook that he was heartbroken at the news, and that it was sudden and it was disappointing. Clearly, FNX was a bit of a warrior, having won Grade One races at different tracks over long distances over different years. He was a New York bred who rose to about as far height as you could go, running second in the Breeders' Cup Classic to none other than American Pharoah. Trained by Jimmy Jerkins, brought along and patiently as always, ridden by Mike Smith, FNX won a number of Grade One races, including the Whitney at Saratoga, and we were looking forward to him having a long career at stud. And that's a shame. This game is as we point out all the time, it's dangerous while they're racing, but still, even when they're retired, they're fragile animals, and you can lose someone like him with the shortest of notice. So our condolences to all the connections. Congratulations to Jimmy Jerkins for making that horse what that horse was. Congratulations to Russell Cohn for picking him out and breeding him, and we will be sorely missed. On the racetrack today, on a happier note, and we had hoped that possibly he would call in tonight, but maybe he might yet. But Irad Ortiz today won 5 races on the 9 race card at Belmont. Irad Ortiz continues to light up the board along with his brother Jose. Jose rode today at Keeneland, and Irad won 5 winners, which used to be almost unheard of. It's become more commonplace on big days when they run as many as 14 races. But 5 winners on a 9 race card is still impressive. And Irad won those races today from behind. He won them on the lead. He won them on the dirt. He won them on the grass. Congratulations to Irad Ortiz for 5 winners today. And, you know, once like any other athletes, once jockeys start going well, they seem to make all the correct moves. Congratulations to him, as we said. Again, let me give you the number here if anybody would like to call, 646-716-4442. We've become quite proud on this show of the horses that we highlight going into the weekend, and we've had a pretty good track record, and for the casual player, I hope that this is giving you some interest and gives you an ability to have a winner or two over the weekend. I continue to be impressed by the handicappers we have on each and every week. That being said, today you have just me, unless we have a handicapper call up. So I'll give you 646-716-4442. Perusing the cards this week, I focused largely on the 3 race days at Belmont, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and also have looked briefly at the card in Maryland, where it's Maryland Million Day, and a number of Maryland breds will run on Saturday at the newly refurbished Laurel Park. Of course, Maryland Million Day for many, many years was highlighted by Ben's Cat, another horse who we lost this year right after his retirement. It's hard to look at a Maryland Million card without Ben Cat's presence, because we've become so used to and so accustomed to seeing him running those grass sprints. That being said, I have spent some time today on the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday cards at Belmont, and come up with a couple of selections and a couple of things to note. So before we get to that, let me give you the phone call again. If anybody would like, 646-716-4442. We start Friday at Belmont tomorrow, and we start right in the first race. And our friends at Zilla Racing continue to be active in the New York racing scene, continue to run horses pretty regularly, continue in the claiming game. And they're running back a horse they claimed called Married to the Music. Married to the Music, they claimed only a few days ago. They run back in a real quick turnaround off the claim. Ray Handel, who's been a guest on this show and is a good, talented, up-and-coming trainer, finds the right spot and wheels him right back for the obligatory 25% raise, but he seems to be in a very good position tomorrow for Zilla to get an immediate return on their money, and we'll root for them. We move to the third race on Friday, and if you recall, people who listen to the show regularly will recall that 2 weeks ago we interviewed Todd Pletcher to congratulate him on his Saratoga championship, and we spoke a little bit about the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and we highlighted two horses that he had entered in the same race on the undercard. And Todd Pletcher told us that both of them were talented, expensive yearlings, co-owned by this by the same on the common ownership, and that they both could be expected to run very well first time out, and they both were hopefully expected to be part of the Triple Crown trail next year. As Todd Pletcher told us, he ran one of those horses and scratched the other. He ran Montauk, and you might recall Montauk ran off the screen, winning by 10 or 12 lengths, paying a little better than even money, and won in the easiest fashion, and is now, in fact, being pointed to the, I'm told, being pointed to the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. The horse that was on the also eligible that day and whom they scratched was, of course, called Navistar. And Navistar is entered in tomorrow's third race. It's a relatively small field, but it will be interesting to watch Navistar. As Todd Pletcher said, the two of them were working together and that the they both seem to be ready to run first time out. And if Montauk and his romp and his debut is any gauge, Navistar in race three tomorrow will be extremely tough. As an aside, one of the fun things about this game I've found over the years is to actually spot stars up and coming and remember their first race. So while this is a small field tomorrow, I think a lot of us will be proud to remember that we saw Montauk's first race and that we spoke to Todd Pletcher on the show about him before he ran. Likewise, maybe the same can be said about Navistar. So tomorrow, if you have an opportunity, race three, around 2 o'clock or so, would be worthwhile tuning in to see Navistar's debut and see whether or not he's as good as Montauk is or as good as advertised by Todd Pletcher here on the show. Continuing tomorrow, this is not a very exciting pick, but it seems like Chad Brown wins a race on the grass each day at Belmont this time of year, all year probably, but tomorrow seems to be no exception. Race 8, he runs a horse called Call Provision, which probably will be a short price, but it's again, if you're looking to to make a single bet tomorrow and maybe pick up a few dollars, you could do worse than going with Call Provision. With that, we'll move on to Saturday's races. Saturday's races, an 11 race card, all New York breds. Used to be tremendously exciting because it was a bit of a novelty. Used to be once a year. Now it tends to be a few times a year. And much like rivalry games that never happened, Islanders, Rangers, Mets, Yankees, Louisville, Kentucky, the excitement wears off when it's done continuously. It loses its specialness. There are a number of New York bred cards run now by the New York Racing Association over the year, with the Friday before the Travers coming to mind and another day in the spring. But in any event, the New York bred race, which used to be the culmination of the year, which used to have a lot of excitement, doesn't really hold as much interest as it once did. But nevertheless, there'll be a lot, at Belmont Saturday, there'll be a lot of owners and breeders and a lot of New York people in the horse racing business out at Belmont, and let's hope it shows the track itself shows some life with some people being there. With that, the 11 races, it's kind of hard to pick out the New York breds. New York breds tend to be an evenly matched bunch. A couple of things stand out, though. In race three, Pico Uno for Jason Service has just blossomed and is just incredibly tough right now. Pico Uno might be a short price, but I think he's in top form, and sometimes when these horses get in top form like that, they just continue to run that way. And I would see Pico Uno, barring some unforeseen bad luck, running very well and probably winning the third race at Belmont on Saturday. So that's race three, Belmont, Saturday, Pico Uno. Continuing on the Saturday card, race seven, we have a horse called Discretionary Mark, who you remember was a selection on this show, and Mike Monroe and I thought the horse would be 6-5 or 7-5. He turned out being paying 5-2 and won as easily as he could. He comes back after break his maiden, beautifully bred for the grass. Christopher Clement seems to be a horse who has all the talent and all the upside. And while that jump to running from maiden special weight to beat winners is normally difficult. Discretionary Mark seems to be talented enough, and I would expect him to run well in race 7 on Saturday, again displaying his talents for the New York bred crowd. Race 9 on Saturday, we continue on with a horse called Kuntia, a horse for Jimmy Jerkins, who seems to be tremendously talented, and I'll speak to Jimmy about this, but he seems to be a handful. Kuntia tends to be difficult to ride in his races, has been disqualified once. Kuntia tends to lose his cool a little bit in the paddock, seems to overheat in the post-parade, and a lot of times that affects his performance. Some of the bad races that he's had, it was pretty clear to me that he had expended a lot of wasted effort in the post-parade or in the paddock. Saratoga comes to mind last year and this year as being subpar efforts because of his inability to maintain his mental stability during the warm-ups. His last race actually was very good. Belmont seems to suit him with the wide turns. The cool weather seems to suit him, as does the relative big size and paucity of crowd out at Belmont. I would expect Kuntia to run a very big race on Saturday, provided he keeps his act together. And this may require a little work on Better's part to try to observe and take a look and see how he behaves in both the paddock and more importantly, in the post-parade on his way to the gate. In the 10th race at Belmont, there's no real selection here, but we have a bit of an oddity. In the 10th race, this has happened before. These horses have met before, but it still is odd. Half-sisters meet each other in a stake race at Belmont on Saturday. JC's American Dream is a 6-year-old, and her younger sister, 5-year-old JC Shooting Star, face off against each other in a stakes race. They've met before, but it's still a bit of an oddity and worth noting for our listeners. Before we get to Sunday, again, let me leave the phone message up here, phone number up here, in case we have anybody who wants to call, 646-716-4442. Now moving on to Sunday, and again, it's always difficult to kind of look this far in advance, but that's what we try to do here on the show, and I guess our familiarity with these horses allow us to handicap relatively quickly. Sunday is a tremendous race card at Belmont. Normally the Saturday card is better than the Sunday card. I tend to like this Sunday card for a couple of reasons. So if you can pull yourself away from the NFL and spend a final fall weekend out at Belmont or at least watching the television, I'm going to give you three horses that you might want to take a look at. We begin right in the second race. The second race has a horse called News Anchor. News Anchor is trained by Chug McGahee. News Anchor should have won his first race. He closed tremendously at a big price and looked like he had all the potential in the world. Chug McGahee is not necessarily known for winning with first-timers, although he did win with a first-timer today at Keeneland, just to belie that belief. But News Anchor came back and was close to even money, a little better than even money, and had a race that under Joel Rosario, where he looked like he could have beaten the field at any time. As a matter of fact, he was so confident that Joel Rosario didn't mind being stuck on the inside, staying the ground the whole way. It looked like he could kind of go by at any time. Sure enough, he managed to get buried down inside. Didn't get an opportunity to get out, tried to get out, got bumped, got stopped. Looked like the race was a foregone conclusion, that he'd be out of the money, and then put in a tremendous late run and really kind of had a bit of an indecisive ride once he got clear. I'm not sure Joel Rosario thought he could get there and wasn't 100% sure. So I would think News Anchor will win at a short price on Sunday. It's a short price, but take it. In the third race, one of our old friends, Life in Shambles, is a horse who's been looking for a good spot and is winless this year, has been looking for a good spot to get a win, and I think he's found his field Sunday, provided the racetrack is dry. We do have a caller here I'm going to take in a minute. Please hold on. So Life in Shambles in the third race, I think, has finally found his spot. And he'll be ridden by the very hot-riding Irad Ortiz. In the seventh race, this is Sunday, the seventh race. We're excited, and if you go back and listen to our interview with Mark Cassie last week, he was excited about a horse he owns, trains called Super Tappet. He spoke specifically about this horse last week and said that this horse has a tremendous amount of talent and that he expects this horse to win this week and he expects this horse to go on to bigger and better things. So I would try to make sure you stay around till Sunday at seventh race on Sunday at Belmont Super Talent. Finally, and before we get to our caller, finally, if you go back to Saturday at Laurel, there's one horse I would like to focus upon. That's in the fourth race, and that's a horse called Blue Moon Ace, a solid, solid sprinter who should have these Maryland breds at his mercy. With that, let me take this caller. Good evening. Welcome to Racetrackers.
Good evening, Bill. How are you today?
Yeah, how are you, Jay? Nice to have you. Jay Dollarscar. How are you, Jay?
I'm okay, Bill. It's great to hear you. And a lot of nice racing coming up. It looks like this week a little light, but it looks like the Maryland Million card. And I guess New York has the New York Showcase on Saturday. I didn't look at it yet, but I'm keeping in the loop to see what's going on. Because, of course,
yeah.
I'm focused on the Breeders' Cup. But we've had some pretty good quality races over the last couple of weeks.
Well, you know, the Maryland Million is not the same without Ben's Cat, obviously. And the New York bred races are not as fun as it used to be when it was once a year. And for some reason, they're running the Empire Classic early on the card. I'm not really sure why. But it's 11 races on Saturday. It probably has an early post time. Speaking of New York breds, Jay, I guess you heard the news about FNX passing away yesterday.
Yeah, I saw that. It's a sad thing. It's really sad. You know, he's really nice. Only a nice New York bred. Had a, nice career. You know, it would have been nice to see him at least, being able to enjoy after his racing career. But
he was a hard knocker, right? Who tried to retire, it seemed, and his only poor races were out in California, and then he avenged his loss in California by going out there and winning out there too.
Yeah. I mean, he was a nice little gutty, try knocking horse. We've had some nice New York breds over the past couple of years, but it's a sad story. It is for racing.
Russell Cohn is a character. He's been a guest on the show, and he was proud of that horse. He bred that horse, named that horse, owned him, ran him the whole time, and of course Jimmy Jerkins took him and made him into a star. And
I love those silks too, by the way.
You like your silks? Okay.
Yeah. I thought that was a pretty neat silk,
That's funny. That was great. Jay, what about IRAD's five winner? Well, let's go back a little bit. Jay, what did you think of Ruba Linda last week in the Pebble? She won, but she certainly wasn't as impressive as she's been previously.
I wasn't impressive, but I guess, this is the first time she was stretching out going further. But she seemed like she's a handful to ride. She looks like she's pretty difficult. I guess that was the first time. We have to give her another opportunity because she was all out. I mean, she was all out to win that race. And, that was a blanket finish,
Right. She was all out. Maybe she got a little lonely on the lead. She was not used to being on the front. But, we'll have to wait and see. Or maybe she's better sprinting than she is routing.
Yeah, maybe. We'll have to give her a second look, like you and I said. With that said, the Chewy 2 was very interesting. It was a really interesting race. Run at Chino. I mean, I was very disappointed with Me Honey Money's performance. But she was really laughing up in the post parade. I don't know if you saw that race. So.
We didn't speak about that, Jay. You're right. The QE2, the stakes race running Keeneland on the Saturday, and again, Mark Cassie, our guest, won it with La Coronel, who he told us would love that racetrack and love those turns, and probably needed to have a little more friendly confines at Keeneland than she had at Saratoga. Did win it, and you're right. The big disappointment was New Money Honey for Chad Brown. And New Money Honey, you're right, was all lathered up and all sweated up. And I don't really know whether it happened in the paddock or the post parade. Did you see any of that beforehand?
No, I was looking at her, and I don't know. I think it was in the post parade from the point that I had it on, you know. And yeah, so that was very interesting. Like I was really surprised with all that said and done. And then Chad's other horse, Uni, who had beat La Coronel previous, but although in a small field, I mean, she didn't show up neither. I mean, she didn't show up. And actually, I thought, it's interesting that we're bringing that race up, Bill, because that horse, Thaddeus, who ran against Rubelina, ran against the Honey Money early in the year, and I think that was her first race. Was it Thaddeus that ran against the Honey Money in that race where she was coming on late?
And it's the same colors and same owner. I'm not 100% sure it was the same horse. It's Peter Brandt's horse, right? But I'm not so sure it was Thaddeus. I'm not sure. It might have been.
Okay. Because I'm just trying to figure out because that was pretty interesting, you know, see how, that was a really interesting race. But you don't have any money. I mean, she loved Keeneland, I guess, you know, and she proved it, you know?
La Coronel. La Coronel.
Sorry. La Coronel loved Keeneland. I mean, like, 3-for-3 over there. I mean, and, man, that's how Luscano, I mean, I just feel like Luscano is underrated. You know, I mean, he's a good turf rider. I mean, he just doesn't get the mounts that some of these guys get, you know. And he makes the best of them, I guess.
You know, it is, you know, it is a function of talent and opportunity. And you're right, there's only so many good horses to go around, and if you're not one of the hot riders right now, sometimes you have to claw your way to and make the best of the ones you have, and he seems to have done that. Jay, two other things I want to mention, I guess, that I hadn't mentioned before. It looks like El Deal is out of the Breeders' Cup now, out of the Breeders' Cup sprint, which I guess is a little bit surprising.
I'm surprised.
It looks like... Yeah, it looks like Jorge Navarro's had another drug positive at Monmouth, and I don't know if those two are related or not, but El Deal is out of the sprint. So that was one of the horses I guess you would expect to give Dre Fong a challenge.
Boy, I think that horse might have taken it to Dre Fong. But this is interesting. Speaking of the Breeders' Cup, there's a couple. I want Dre Fong to win it back to back years, just like Baffert's horse did Midnight Loot in 2007 and 2008. So, but
right.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, from what I've read, you know, I mean, they said Mind Your Biscuit's been training well. I mean, that other West Coast horse, that Roy H horse. The sprint, that's still, I mean, it's a tough loss for them losing El Deal, you know? I mean, that would have really put some pressure on DeFranc. It wouldn't really have, you know? So, I mean, now we got to see who, what are the speed there's actually in that race that will be able to help those closers, you know what I mean? Because Mind Your Biscuit, I mean, I think Tiff Furlong to me is sponsoring Mind Your Biscuit, but he's just going to need that pace to close into him and Whitmore from Marmore Kent Barn. And Whitmore is going to Breeders' Cup Sprint as well. And he ran a nice race at Keeneland. That was a blanket finish too. I wonder if Limousine Liberal will show up there. I mean,
Limousine Liberal is not going. They've announced that Limousine Liberal, who I thought was best in that race, I thought going in he was best. I thought he was the best horse in the race. He just had a tough trip. He's awaiting next year when it's run at Churchill Downs. He's a gelding, and they're gonna avoid going out west, and they're gonna wait till next year. So hopefully we'll be talking about him a year from now. Jay, are you going out to Del Mar?
It's very interesting, Bill. Usually, I've been to Del Mar before. So what happened is, like, I make it really quick. A friend of mine has a filly running called Best Performance, and I'm very good friends with her. And once I found out that the filly was going to be running, so I decided I'm going to go to Del Mar and head out. And I literally, maybe like about a week, 2 weeks ago, I made plans. So not kidding.
Okay,
cool. 2 weeks ago, I made plans. But I'm just only going like for usually like I like to go to the Breeders' Cup and do like about a week, you know, a week and everything, you know. But this year I'm just only going for 3 days. That's all. I mean, like I'm in and out. Like I want to be there to support my friend, like and her that nice filly that she has Best Performance is running on Friday in the Juvenile Turf.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
So like I mean. She's a really nice filly. She's ran both on dirt and turf, you know. So they've got a bright future with her. And she's with the West Point Thoroughbreds.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, so I mean, so she'd be funny though. It'd be a nice, you know.
That's
nice
a nice
day.
Horse.
I mean,
is that the horse that won up in Canada? Or is that another one at West Point?
No, that's another one of West Point. I know the one you're talking about. But the one that's gonna run this at the Breeders' Cup. She's a 2 year old. She ran it on Kentucky Downs, and she's been running very, very well. I mean, like, if you look at her PPs. She's collected multiple checks, running second in a couple nice, you know, she had a nice stakes second at Kentucky Downs, and she ran second at Saratoga in the 2 year old stake race up there. I can't remember. It was a Canadian horse that beat her. I think what's the girl race? Is it the Skylarville? Maybe might have been for the girl.
I don't know. They blend in every once in a while. I can't keep them straight. I used to know them when they changed the order of them, and I can't remember which is which.
Yeah.
But one of the 2 year old stakes races.
Yeah. So yeah, she had ran second to a trainer who very rarely seldomly ships horses up to Saratoga, and that horse ran off the screen, but Best Performance ran second. So like she's a very nice filly. So they've got like some promising hope for her, you know, on both either turf or dirt. You know, she started out sprinting and then like they stretched her out. So they decided that they're gonna go to the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Filly Turf with her. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Anything that you're looking for?
I have a family event, so I won't be able to go out. I hope to go out to Kentucky next year. And this year, I can't make it. I don't know what to make it a classic, and we'll talk more about it in the next couple of weeks. I guess Arrogate has worked a little bit better, but I'm still not sold that he's back to who he was. And they're announcing his retirement makes me think even more that maybe he's lost a little bit of zip.
Yeah, well, you know, with Judmont, you know, I'm not surprised that they kind of made the announcement of retirement. I mean, because whether he wins the Breeders' Cup or he doesn't, I'm like, you say to yourself, what else what he has left to do. You know what I mean? To come back next year, you know, I mean, it would be nice to see. It's nice when we get to see the horses come back as a 5-year-old. But I mean, like, what else would he have left to, you know? Because he's won the Breeders' Cup, he's won the Dubai World Cup. Now he's gonna
I thought he would have stayed around for the Pegasus, maybe. That's one of the things I was thinking about. That the Pegasus is a big enough to be a back-to-back winner. Of that might be really, you know, something worth aiming for. But if you know, if it's the end of the road, it's the end of the road, right?
Yeah. It is. Well, they announced that they're going to aim the other gunrunner to the Pegasus. Apparently, that's what they said.
I would think so. And I'm hoping to have Steve Asmussen on next week, and maybe even Ferran Tarou, because Gunrunner, I guess, has done nothing wrong, continues to work up a storm.
Boy,
let's hope we manage to get them.
After the Dubai World Cup, I mean, if you look at Gunrunner, really, last year, I really loved him as a 3-year-old, and I loved him as a 2-year-old, but he is just like has done nothing after the run. I mean, he ran in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile and just nearly beat all the horses. Lost to Tasmar Q, and of course, what's that horse that was favored in that race but hasn't really lifted up the hoof? Hold on, it'll come to you. But it's really interesting. So, I mean, ever since that Breeders' Cup race, he lost, barely lost, and then he came back, he won the Clark, and then, I mean, he just has just progressed and gotten even better. No disgrace to losing the Arrogate, but, I mean, he just has moved forward, you know. Sometimes they have that Dubai bounce before. He has just moved forward.
He's gotten better and better, and he doesn't need the lead. He's not necessarily a speed horse yet. He's fast enough to be forwardly placed. I mean, he's got a lot going for him, you know. And my guess is he'll probably be favored in the Breeders' Cup Classic.
Huh? Yeah, I would really think so. I was listening to a comment. I think it was John. It might have been John White. He makes the more line odds. I think it was John White, obviously. But he has really been really highly that. He said that he really felt that Baffert's other horse is going to win the Breeders' Cup Classic. Collected?
Okay.
Yeah.
He's kind of the forgotten horse, right? Collected is a little bit forgotten.
Yeah, he's forgotten because they're thinking, you know, West Coast. You know, I mean, West Coast is, I mean, he's a super horse. But I'm just thinking every time I think of these 3-year-olds, and I mean, I love Curlin, but that's how that year when Curlin won the Breeders' Cup, that's how good the 3-year-olds was. Compared to the 4-year-old, compared to the older horse division that year was not as that stellar. You know, but it goes to show you. I mean, it would be nice to see if West Coast. I really don't think West Coast can do it because I just feel like. You remember when Bernardini, and of course when he raced that year, Bernardini was like the second best 3-year-old that year, and then and then Invasor just inhaled him. I mean. I don't know. So I mean, like he could prove me wrong, Bill. But like, I don't know.
Three-year-olds beating older horses are tough. That's
very tough, especially at that time of the year. You know,
right.
I mean, like, you know, but that's what makes racing interesting, Bill. But I just feel like I don't think West Coast. I don't think West Coast is going to win it.
Okay. Well, we'll have to wait and see how it develops and how they work out over the week, and we'll have more to talk about that at that time, you know, during the week leading up to it. Jay, I think what I'll do, my guest tonight is Craig Mulkowski, and he makes the Time Form USA Figures, and I taped an interview with him earlier today, and I try to have him on at 8:30. So if you don't mind, we'll go to him, and then I'm going to wrap up the show.
Yeah.
So maybe Jay, we'll let you go. I'll play the I'll play this interview. I hope you listen, and we'll talk next week.
Likewise, it was always a pleasure. Okay, Bill.
Good. Thank you. Jay Dallascar, everyone. Thank you, Jay.
Okay.
Right. Always happy to hear from Jay. Jay's got a tremendous opinion, tremendous racing fan, travels all over the place, but a really, really good handicapper and a really good opinion on racing. And a great dancer up in Saratoga to boot. With that, as I mentioned, I had the opportunity to speak earlier today with Craig Mulkowski, who makes time figures. He makes his own time figures, pace figures for Timeform USA. And I had an opportunity to speak with him. We talked about a number of different things, and I hope you'll enjoy it.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome Craig Mulkowski to Racetrackers. Hello, Craig.
Hey, Bill. How are you doing today? Glad to be able to join you.
Fine. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. We've been meaning to have you on for a while now to discuss your speed figures and the way you make your speed figures and the complexity that goes along with it and a little bit about your operation. But for introduction for some of our listeners, you now work for Timeform US and you put together your own speed figures that are widely shared on the internet, done on the Daily Racing Form. And tell us a little bit about your business and how you got involved.
I started out, I used to have my own website, pacefigures.com, which kind of is a story in and of itself. I made speed and pace figures for myself, like most people do, and when they start out. And I published a few things, and War Emblem was a horse that when I was on the internet, on message boards, especially Pace Advantage, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that one. But I would talk about my speed figures, and War Emblem was a guy that jumped out in the Illinois Derby, so I was talking him up, and then, he went on to win the Kentucky Derby. And from there, people started asking me about him and if they could buy him. And, believe it or not, it was never a goal of mine to sell speed figures. It was just for myself, but after a while, people keep asking. It was kind of hard to turn down. So, that's kind of how it got started. And, I did that for – I want to say close to a decade, and I was actually still in the military at the time, so I had a guy named Jared Brush who was helping me. He's since moved on. He works in a casino in Ohio now. I think he's kind of left the racing business, but he was a big help to me, and I did that once I retired from the Air Force, and a few years later, Mark Attenberg approached me, who was starting up Timeform US. He had left DRF to start his own company at the time, and he offered me a deal I couldn't refuse, and that's how I wound up with Timeform US.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, making your own speed figures is an audacious endeavor. There are enough speed figures out there, and many people rely upon published speed figures that exist. What made you want to make your own speed figures as opposed to relying on some of the existing figures that are out there?
For me, it was mostly and it's not a knock on people who do speed figures, but I found them to be, the more popular they got, the more disappointing they were at the betting window. And I think a lot of that, from my experience, had to do with pace. I think people ignored pace too much. And granted, we're talking quite a while ago, when I started. Nowadays, everybody talks about pace and they're pretty familiar with it, but that was the thing. And there were some pace figures available and some of the various pace past performances. But once I looked at them, I wasn't impressed at all. I didn't think they did a very good job. And, frankly, I thought I could do it better. So that's how I started out. It wasn't so much about the final time figures, because I think pretty much anyone can do those. If they read a few books, they're not too tough, but it's doing the pace figures in conjunction with them. I think it tells us so much more about a race than speed figures alone.
Okay. Well, I mean, at its essence, I guess the whole racetrack gambling game is about having an edge. I mean, I'm old enough to recall that when the sheets first came around, they were only in the hands of a very few people, and it provided a tremendous edge because they pointed out long priced horses. Now, I guess with the prevalence of people using sheets and other type of speed figures, you kind of wind up going with the pack, and maybe you don't get the price edge or the odds edge that you otherwise would get. Do you find that your figures come up with different selections than the typical figures would, and are you more geared towards longer priced horses?
I am geared towards longer priced horses, and you know, I'm not saying that my speed figures are no holy grail. I mean, they measure what they measure, and you use them from there. But, you know, I've kind of adapted. It's pretty easy to figure out that the fastest speed figure horses get bet the most heavily. Most of the time, all the speed figures are going to point to the same couple horses. What I like to do is use speed figures and pace figures to assess trips in the race, and I also like to use them to assess form. I'm a big form guy. I look for horses that are improving or I think have hidden form that maybe, you know, some tough trips, be it pace or, you know, just traffic troubles or whatever. Those are the kind of horses I look for because those are the ones that pay prices. You can go broke pretty quick in this game if you're betting 3-2 shots that have the highest speed figure all the time. So I got away from that, and, yeah, I use the speed figures in probably a little bit different way than most people seem to think speed figures are used for.
Well, I mean, that's why I bring it up, because I realize that. I know in other sports there's a concept called visualization. So you visualize how you can win the game, or you visualize how you could get out of the inning as a pitcher, or you visualize how you could score a touchdown as a football team. I guess at its essence, pace figures are a visualization of the race. So you picture yourself, you try to picture how the race will be run and who will have the advantage and how it will shake out. I mean, is that an accurate assessment of what pace handicapping is really all about?
Yeah, I think there's two aspects. I mean, the one is that you're looking at the race coming up and you're trying to assess what's going to happen, who's going to lead, is there going to be pressure? You know, does it set up for closers? Or maybe it does set up for closers and the closers just aren't any good, so the race can fall apart and the speed still wins. And the other aspect is just looking at it at races that have already been run as a, you know, almost an in-race bias. You look at the pace figures, and if on my scale, for example, if I see the final time was a 90 and the half mile in a 6-furlong race was 120, I know that race probably favored horses that are coming from off the pace. So, you know, I'm going to probably dock them a little bit and upgrade the horses who, you know, were up front and maybe quit and don't have the best final time numbers, but they definitely ran better than looked. And particularly, I don't put ground loss in my speed figures, but I'm real big on, and this is part of what I talked about with looking for hidden form, horses who were caught wide during the fast part of the race. I do believe ground loss matters, but I also believe it matters when it happens and what was going on at the race at the time.
Okay, so the idea being when the real running begins, if you're forced wide, that's more detrimental than if you're loping along at a time being outside when you're loping along isn't quite as detrimental.
Yeah, exactly. I used to run quite a bit in my younger days, but when my knees would allow it. And I always like to use the analogy, if I go out to the track and I walk around the track with somebody of similar ability, and the first turn I walk on the outside and he walks on the inside, I can keep up and expend very little extra energy. But if then we hit the second turn and we take off sprinting and I try to keep up, it's either impossible, or if I do keep up, I'm never going to be able to finish. So, you know, that's the part of the race that, you know, I look for when it's hot. And we indicate that with red fractions in our past performances. So when I see a horse is wide in those fast fractions, I definitely want to take a deeper look.
I guess when speed figures first came out, one of the things that I always found problematic in my assessment of them was, how do you handle when a race is over and a rider does the correct thing and saves a horse for another day? I mean, I guess I've always thought that the last 70 yards of a race, if a horse is not closing or doesn't have a chance, really doesn't seem to matter very much. Yet that seems to be, of course, is factored into the final time. It's factored into ground loss. And eventually it finds its way into speed figures. How do you adjust for that when a speed horse is finished and not putting out any effort, or when a closer is too far behind and decides to wait for another day.
Yeah, I'll be as a speed figure maker. I don't do anything. I leave that to the handicapper. The horses run the time they run, and they get rated off of that. But I would say, you know, you got to watch the races and see what happened. You can see when horses get wrapped up on. And the other thing I would say is I'm very leery of trusting speed figures very much for horses that are well beaten in a race, just because of what you said. That can be when they actually run fast figures as well. Sometimes they just get sucked along. They're running against way better horses, and they don't reproduce the same effort when they drop down in class. But the situation you're talking about where horses probably could have run, you know, 2, 3, 4 lengths faster had the jockey urged them, but they didn't do it. You know, all I can say is watch the races. There's no way to numerically account for that, I don't think, so I don't even try.
Okay. Well, I mean, since largely this is a numerical exercise, I guess what is this? There's a saying in computer language, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So you're really dependent upon the accuracy of the timing that the racetracks have put forth, or you have to go back and make your own assessment of the timing. We've had some conversations on Twitter about how puzzling some of the timing has been at various racetracks and the accuracy thereof. I mean, that seems to be a big issue right now.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's been so many even big races recently. We had the Pegasus this year, which was the richest race in the world, was mistimed. A week and a half ago, we had the Santa Anita Sprint Championship, a major Grade 1 race that a lot of horses will be running back in the Breeders' Cup Sprint was mistimed. And there's just races all the time. I mean, just yesterday at Belmont, they had a turf race with a ridiculous third quarter. I think it was the fourth race. And it's not so much that the errors happen. You know, nothing's perfect, no timing system, but there's no real checks and balances in our sport. That time is in the chart today, a 109 and change, when in reality it was a 112. There was a race run at Zia Park on, what is today, Thursday. So it was on Tuesday, where the fractions, anybody who follows horse racing at all could just look at the race and go, what in the world are, you know, races just aren't run like that. And, you know, so stuff happens. Zia Park's terrible, by the way. I don't know what they're doing there, but they're missing fractions for probably between 10 and 15% of the races. You know, and it's the kind of stuff you have to deal with. I get a lot of people that tell me, you know, as a speed figure maker guy, if I would just be quiet and use it for my own benefit, you know, I would have a paramutual edge. But, you know, you got to look at the big picture and what's good for the game. And I think most people want to have accurate data. If you want people to come in and take to the sport in 2017 and bet big money and really try to learn it, they got to be able to rely on the data. And at this point, you just can't.
Well, I guess that's right. I mean, historically, literally for 150 years or so, or 130 years, the racetracks have been responsible for putting out times of the races. And originally, of course, it was done by hand by professionals and measured to the fifth of a second. This is, Craig, I know you know this, but this is for our listeners who some who may not be 100% familiar. They used to measure the races in 1/5 of a second. Now, of course, we go to hundredths of a second because it's more accurate, or I guess there's a feeling that that's more valuable, although I tend to still think in fifths of a second. And now they've outsourced that a little bit more. Is it time, and this is a radical question, I guess, is it time for racetracks to get out of the business of providing that information at all if they're not going to provide it accurately?
No, I think if you stop timing races, people are good. You know, people are not betting horse racing like they did 10 and 15 years ago, let alone 50 years ago. Handle's been dropping. I think if you stop timing races, people are going to flee in a hurry. I mean, it is, after all, a race. If you can't get information like the time of the race, you know, who's going to want to bet that? What I think racetracks need to do is they need to hold these companies accountable. At some point, you know, you're paying these people money to give you something, and they're not doing it. And I guess maybe it's the military part of me. You know, I did 23 years in there, but if we contracted something out to somebody, they darn sure better do the job right or we'll find somebody else. And that just doesn't seem to be happen at racetracks. And part of it, a lot of times, I don't think there's the expertise for people to even know when there's a problem. And you can see that by some of these times that find their way into the official charts. I mean, people just don't know when there's an error, and that's a problem, if you ask me.
Right. Well, there are some things that are just patently ridiculous, and somebody with some knowledge would know to check that to make sure it was correct before you put it out, if you're familiar with the game. And I guess I worked for a great man one time who told me, you know, if you outsource your problems, you just compound them. And this is a problem. Now, some racetracks, and we've had this conversation on Twitter, some racetracks employ a backup timer, a human timer, to automated timing that goes on, and particularly, I guess, the California tracks. Do you find that to be helpful, or is that just further confused the matter?
No, I don't particularly find it to be helpful. I remember when just recently with that Santa Anita Sprint Championship, the CHRB, I believe it was, released a statement about their hand timer, and I'm sure the guy does good, but it's just not an easy thing to do, and that race wound up being about a half second too fast, and if you can't catch a half second in a 6-furlong race, you're probably missing a whole bunch more than that. The tools are available in 2017 to time races off of video easily. I don't know why tracks haven't adopted that as a backup. There's nothing wrong with a guy hand timing and saying, hey, I got vastly different. Maybe we want to take a look at this. But to use it as the official time, it just doesn't work.
Well, I guess that is a question. I mean, the most famous mistimed race, I guess, was Secretariat's Preakness in 1973. And, you know, it's almost technologically the dark ages. You know, CBS would run a split screen of Secretariat running and somebody else or some other race running the same time. And I guess there was always a feeling that maybe it wasn't timing off of video wasn't accurate at the time, but you feel comfortable now that timing off of video, is accurate with today's technology?
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, it's not just that I go time races that I think are wrong. I establish a baseline by just timing tons of races and verifying against the clock. And, 98% of the time they come up perfect, just like they're supposed to once you learn what you're doing. So the ones that are wrong really stick out. It's pretty easy to see. I just don't understand why are we going to put out a hand time 10 minutes after the race and stick with it when if you spend 5 minutes in time from the video, you could give the customer something more accurate.
Right. And while you're timing literally hundreds of races a day, each racetrack is only responsible for their 8, 9, 10, 12 races. I mean, it wouldn't seem to be so difficult a task to employ somebody to make sure that those races are accurate.
Right. Now, don't let me mislead. I'm not timing every race. I time when I look at my worksheets that I do to make speed figures and I see an anomaly. That's now when I mean, there's no way I could time every single race. I mean, I'd need a team of people to do that. But I do go look and I look at the ones that stick out, and sometimes they're fine. It's not like every time I see something that looks fishy, there's a bad time, but probably 50-50 there is, and it might not even be a clocking error. It could be the Equibase guy fat-fingered putting the time into the chart or something like that, and I'll usually catch that right off the video where the final time will show 111.12, and they'll put in 112.11 or something
okay.
like that. So.
Right. Well, I want to get back to your operation and how what a task it is. But let's, for our listeners, just let's speak about one other thing. There's the concept of run-up times. And for our listeners who don't know, the race is not in fact timed at all from when they break from the gate. Traditionally in horse racing, things are timed from a running start, meaning so when they began with the starting gate, the feeling was that they had always timed horses from a running start, and to maintain some consistency when they began using a fixed starting gate, they would also time a race from a running start. So they would actually time it from a pole that was between 10 and 50 yards from the starting gate, and that's where the timing would actually Yeah, so a 6 furlong race is in effect more than 6 furlongs. It's 6 furlongs and 20 yards or 30 yards. How does the change in distance on the run up affect final times? I assume the longer the run up, the faster the final time.
You know, usually you can't say that with fact because a lot of it depends on the pace of the race. If the horses don't come busting out of the gate and nobody really wants to lead, the run up may not have any effect at all. If they're flying out of the gate, it certainly does. And just as an overall broad example, you can look at the races at Churchill. 6 furlongs have a really long run-up. They're almost 6.25 mile races. 6.25 furlongs, I should say, races. And you look at the fractions, and they're always really fast. They're usually 21 and change. I think they've even broken 21 a few times there. And then you can compare it to Pimlico, which – you know, the starting gate's backed right up at the end of the chute next to the parking lot. I think they list the run up at 5 feet, and they can barely ever break 23. And, you know, so it's not just the fractions that are different. That carries over throughout the race. I mean, horses can only run so fast. So without that running start, it definitely has an effect on the final time. So if you're using speed charts to compare races, like I'm sure most people have read some of Byers' books where he has speed charts for all the different things, that match up what a 80 is at 6 furlongs and 6.5 and 7. You know, they work, but you also have to account for that run-up because it can definitely skew things. And tracks don't use the same run-up at different distances. So, for example, Santa Anita runs mile races. They have almost a football field worth of run-up. And then a mile and a 16th, they use a much shorter run-up. So if you're using the same speed chart at different tracks, you're going to get some skewed results there.
Right. Well, I mean, it's even, again, for our listeners, it's even more complicated in grass races because sometimes they have a different run-up at the same distance if they run two races on the same day. And I believe that's largely a function of not leaving a huge divot on the ground from the starting gate, starting in the same place on two races. So I know Gulfstream, for example, will change the run-up time, run-up distance, rather, even if they run two races at 7.5 furlongs. It's one run-up, one race, and a different one the next.
Yes, definitely. I use different baselines for all of those, but, it makes it really tough to make speed figures, and it is what it is. I mean, I do the best I can with that. But what happens is you don't have apples-to-apples comparison, so you have less horses to look at when you're trying to make the numbers, and they're not going to be as good. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Right. But your process tried to take into account all of that, and it's why a speed figure is necessary. If there's somebody like yourself making a judgment based on experience, trying to compare different circumstances and different setups, and that's why they become valuable. You now are in a process. You put out, correct me if I'm wrong, but you put out time speed figures on almost every track in the country. And how do you do that? Do you have a staff who works with you, or is that something you do on your own?
I did it on my own for a while until about 6 months ago. I actually have another guy who's helping me out. He does about a quarter of the tracks. But a part of that is I've learned over the years how to manipulate a computer. I do quite a bit of computer programming. So all the grunt work, as we say, is done by the computer. The actual speed figures and figuring out the track variant I'm going to use is a manual process. But all the rest of it, you know, I press a few buttons at the end of the racing day. I download the files, and everything's laid out for me and my assistant nice and neat. So it's probably not as hard as it sounds. I mean, I can usually do a track in – 5 minutes at the most. If it's a problem day where I got to go watch replays, it might be as long as 15 or 20 minutes. But, I can knock them out pretty easy. It's not like back in the old days where everything was pencil and paper and, it might take an hour just to do a track. It's not like that anymore. At least for me, it's not.
Right. Well, you're probably being too modest, though, because it's still a nonstop effort. I mean, the one thing about this game is it never stops. And it's 7 days a week, and any handicapper knows if you turn your head for a minute, or you take a week off, you miss something you've been waiting for. And if you take 2 weeks off, it takes you 4 weeks to get back and in the same level of knowledge that you had. Well, Craig,
there's no weeks off for me, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the problem with it. It never stops. As anyone who knows people who love the races know that there's we've said this before. We used to say, oh, how can you plan something like Kentucky Derby Day? And then my wife points out, well, there's also Preakness Day and Belmont Day and Preakness Cup Day and Saratoga and Gulfstream and Pegasus. There's always something. So.
Yeah, my wife's learned the same thing. So I hear the same exact comment. So I know where you're coming from.
Right. It's almost reached ridiculous proportions now that we pay attention to Winx in Australia. I'm saying things like, how can you plan something at 2:30 in the morning on a Saturday?
One thing I won't do is try to make speed figures for Australia. I've been tempted because I want to know how good she is, but I've kind of written that one off. There's only so much time in the day.
You leave that to someone else. Well, tell us if you can. Slowly, and I don't mean to be slowly, but take your time to plug where our listeners can find your speed figures and what the website is. And sometimes I'm accused on the show of things going too quickly for people. So tell us again where we can find your speed figures and where we can follow you on Twitter and on the web.
Okay, yeah, no problem. Our website is www.timeformus.com. You can also purchase us through DRF. We are owned by Daily Racing Form, so at www.drf.com. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's TimeformUS is one, and then my personal one is TimeformUS Figs, FIGS, at the end of the TimeformUS. So you have to put up with me talking about some sports there if you follow me. Mostly I stick to horse racing and sports, very little else, so. That's about it. But Timeform US retweets all my speed figures. So if that's all you're looking for, you can follow them, and you'll do just fine.
Excellent. Well, Craig, I hope you'll come back and join us sometime, and we hope you'll speak a little bit about the speed figures either before or after the Breeders' Cup, particularly after the Breeders' Cup, to see a historical comparison as to where you find this year's Breeders' Cup winners compared to others, which is always kind of interesting. And, I hope you'll continue to put out the good work that you do and join us back here again sometime.
Sure. Anytime you want to have me, let me know. And if you can fit me in, I'll be there.
Great. Everyone, I want to thank Craig Mulkowski. Thank you, Craig.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it, bud.
Well, with that, I hope you enjoyed that interview. I did. It's a complex subject. Speed figures are, there's a lot that goes into them, a lot of work that goes into them, a lot of variables. It's part science, part art, and it can really be a valuable addition to your handicapping tools, and probably a pretty good gift for somebody who has everything. So, we try to highlight various handicapping methods, handicapping tools on the show. And I, without exception, I've found all of the handicappers we have on here to be very intelligent people, very thoughtful people, and very nice people. With that, I guess we're going to wrap up early tonight. Mike is under the weather. We hope we'll have him back next week. As we said, it's a little bit of a slow week. I hope we've gone over everything that we've had. To go back over some of our selections for this week, just to wrap up, if anybody missed it, we like a couple of horses tomorrow. So that's Belmont's Friday race. We like race 1, Married to the Music, race 3, Navistar, race 8, Call Provision. Saturday, we like race 3, Pico Uno, race 7, Discretionary Mark, race 9, Kluntia. Sunday, we have three horses that we like again. Two of them are tremendous bets, I think. One rate on Sunday, the second race at Belmont, News Anchor, the third race, Life in Shambles, and the seventh race, Super Tappet. It's probably a horse who's destined for bigger and better things. And if you're looking to play Laurel, we have only one selection on the card. That's the Laurel race on Saturday, race 4, Blue Moon Ace. So with that, everyone, thanks so much. I hope Mike will be back with us next week. I'm confident he will be. I want to thank Jay Dalaskar. I want to thank Greg Mulkowski. And please spread the word about how much fun we have here. And please get me some comments. It's not always nice to hear from our listeners. Thanks, everyone. Good night.